Anyways, well, let's take our Bibles out and turn to Revelation chapter 6. We'll pick up from last week. Revelation chapter 6, this is part 4 of the scroll with 7 seals that we've been looking at. So again, this is part 4 for those of you that are taking notes. You don't have to, but if you've been using the handout, I give a little bit of an overview so you can have an idea, or outline rather, I should say, as far as what we'll look at this evening. So what we'll do is I'm going to review the setting just one more time. It'd be a brief one. But then, if you were with us last week or not, I'm going to review what we started looking at last week, which is Jesus taking the scroll, you know, and has the 7 seals, and he begins to break the seals. And we looked at the first one because we looked at a series of other things. But I'll do a little bit of a review of the first one. And then we'll look at the remaining 3, which, as I mentioned, and I'll remind you again, we have the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse, which is where we get the first of the 4 seals. And then we'll look to close that out this evening. So we'll look at the 2nd, 3rd, and the 4th ones this evening after I kind of review not only the first seal, but the setting. Okay. If you have the handout, again, you don't have to use it, but if you're taking notes or you want to use the visuals, it might be helpful for you. But in any case, if you remember, of course, Revelation by now, this is being the 4th study on this, what we have is, of course, the Apostle John writing somewhere in the 90s A.D. while on the island of Patmos. He's been exiled there. And I've mentioned a couple of times, while not the most important verse, I'm particularly not a fan of that anyway, but in Revelation 1:19, I told you that's sort of a key verse. It's a key verse in understanding the structure, the flow of the book. So, for example, it tells John to write the things that he had seen. So if you're looking at your handout, you see the outline that we pulled, or I did, from the Ryrie Study Bible. You have the prologue there. And then what John does is exactly what we see there. He writes the things that he had seen. So those would be the things that he saw in terms of seeing the glorified Jesus and those sorts of things. The second part is the things which are. Those are the things that are in chapters 2 and 3. That's the 7 churches. Those would be the present things. And then chapter 4, forward, is, of course, things that were future. If you remember, when you read Revelation chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "And after this, I will tell you the things that will take place after these things." So it's forward-looking, past, present, and then, of course, future. Now, in order to understand what the scroll is, you remember the setting is chapters 4 and 5. So John's taken up into the heaven, into the throne room, and in chapter 4, essentially chapter 4 by now, you probably remember that's where God is being worshipped. It's primarily what you see. You see God there being worshipped, offered continual worship. But then the scene changes in chapter 5, verse 1, and the focus goes to God's hand, and in God's hand is that scroll that we're studying. The scroll, of course, has the problem, which is that no one is worthy. That's the key there. The key word is worthy. There's no one worthy in all of creation except, of course, Jesus. Jesus is worthy because of his sacrifice, because he's from the tribe of Judah, those sorts of things we looked at. Jesus then goes and he takes the scroll, and then heaven erupts in great praise of the Lamb. So whereas chapter 4 worships, we would think, God the Father, it sort of shifts. Jesus takes the scroll. He's going to begin taking back claim of authority over the earth, which is what takes place in the remainder of the book. Now, I did mention this last week, and if you look on the handout, there's the chart. The chart's a little bit unique. There's not a lot of them I've found like this. It says the telescopic judgments of Revelation. We looked at that last week in detail. I'm not going to go back over it. But when you get to the tribulation period, what we see is what happens in chapter 6. As we begin looking at chapter 6, Jesus begins to break the scroll open. He takes one seal off at a time and goes through these various judgments that we're looking at. But if you look at the tape or the chart that's there, you can see it. What we have is four judgments that come in the way of four seals, and those are the same as the four, remember, four horsemen of the apocalypse, if you've ever heard that before. Now, in that chart there, you see where you have, in the tribulation period, a series of three types of judgments, if you will. So you've got the scroll, and on the scroll is seven seals. Jesus breaks those. The last seal is what moves us into the next series of judgments, which is what? What happens, if you remember at the end, there's the seventh trumpet. That seventh trumpet is what moves forward to what? The last is what? The vials or the bowls. So I just tell you that so you can get a concept of what happens. So there's a series of three types of judgments, seals, trumpets, vials, and each of them has seven judgments in them. Now last week we started looking at the first seal. The first seal is in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And on the chart there at the bottom of the handout, we're going to look at this next week. But if you have it right here, you'll notice that I have it compared to Matthew 24. So the very bottom on the left hand. Now, that's something I will do next week. But if you look at the first six seals, you see the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Notice in the chart, you have the white horse. The white one is in verse 2 of chapter 6. The red one is in verse 4. The black one, verse 5. And the pale horse is verse 8. We'll be looking at those last three this evening and such. Now, when we looked at the first one, I'm not going to go back over this one in detail. Obviously, it is recorded. It's out on YouTube, our church website, if you're interested. But the first seal, if we look at it, what comes forth is the first of the four horsemen, which is the white horse. I make the case that it's not a Roman emperor. I told you there's a lot of translations for that, for what the white horse represents. Some think it's Jesus because it is second coming. He has the white horse that he rides on. But I made the case that no, rather the typical better translation is to say that it's the Antichrist or Antichrist, meaning false teachers. And we'll see how that works with Matthew 24 next week. I'm going to read this to you. This is the view I take. I take it's the Antichrist. I'll remind you of why. David Levy writes, "This writer has the markings of a counterfeit, i.e. Antichrist, who arrives on the world stage at the beginning of the tribulation." And I think that's the correct way to see it. I'll look a little bit more at another way of looking at it next week. But if you notice, as the rider on the white horse comes, he's got a bow, but what's missing? Remember? Can't do much damage without arrows, can you? I guess you can beat someone with it, but you're not going to get too far. Of course, the imagery there is that when I believe this is showing the Antichrist. The Antichrist, remember, the Antichrist appears on the scene initially peacefully. I think there's a little bit of a misnomer. We think he comes and he's got his horns and everybody's like, oh, look, it's the devil. No, that's not what happens. Remember, the way to understand the tribulation is our study in Daniel. Daniel chapter 9, in the 70th week prophecy. That really gives you the framework for it, because the Antichrist appears peacefully. In fact, so peacefully, he makes some sort of covenant agreement with God's people, the nation of Israel. If you remember Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. When does everything get really bad related to Antichrist? Yep, right in the middle. So again, you got 7 years. They're all really bad. You'll really begin to see it tonight, even the early stage. It just gets worse. But in terms of the Antichrist, he's going to come on for a brief period of time, but everything changes in the midpoint. Now, before we look at the ones tonight, let me remind you, in Revelation, you don't have to turn here, 13:5, it correlates with Daniel's prophecies and says that he has 42 months in that passage to work. The reason why I keep mentioning this is there's a theme in Revelation that people miss, and Christians of all people need to get this. God gives him a certain period of time to bring forth judgment and evil. Does that make sense? In other words, he doesn't come on the scene and anything, and God doesn't know about it, and then God has no idea of how long it's going to last. God isn't caught off guard. The Lord is in control. He sets the timetable. Even when evil is on the earth, God is aware of how long. And so the Antichrist has a period of time when he's able to work, but no more. And only God could, of course, be in control. I like to think of it as the Lord is in control even when the world is out of control. That's a pretty good comfort, isn't it? Even while evil is let loose, God knows what's going on. And even the epitome of evil has controls around him. In other words, it's not as though he's going to go 8 years. Do you understand? So that's a good reminder there. God sets the timetable on all things. But let's go forward here and let's pick up. So we've seen the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. We're going to see the second, third, and fourth one. If you take notes, the second seal is in verses 3 through 4. So that's the rider on the second horse, the red horse. If you're taking notes, the third seal is in verses 5 and 6. That's black, meaning that's the color black. And then the fourth and final one is death, verses 7 through 8. And that's the ashen, sickly pale horse. Someone read for me verses 3 and 4, so same scene. Jesus has taken the scroll. He's beginning to break the seals, bringing forth these judgments over the entirety of the world. This is not local judgment. This is worldwide judgment, okay? But someone read verses 3 and 4, and we'll look at the second seal. What does it represent, or what does it personify?
And yep. When he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, was given to him.
All right, thank you, Dave. So here, we've seen the first, now we see the second. The first is the white horse, the white on there. And then we see the second one there in verse 4 is red. Red, of course, representative of things like war, bloodshed, violence, and so forth. Now, you'll know that sometimes people refer to the second seal, just, and this is just a way to try to think of it, as war. I think that's fine. You could also think of it as, and I'll show you this, human physical conflict or violence that is done among humans. Okay? And I know you're splitting hairs a little bit there, but I want to show you this as well. So red, of course, we think of war, you think of bloodshed, and those sorts of things. And the one who sat on it was to take peace from the earth. So what happens is you have this removal of peace, but I want you to notice the second part of verse 4. So it says it was granted to him to take peace from the earth. But then notice men kill each other. What it's showing here is that there is this increase in violence and human conflict, but this is conflict even on the individual level. Do you understand the difference? So when you think of war, what do you think of? You think of great big nations and they come up against each other, which obviously happens in the tribulation. But here you'll see where actually you also see where people kill each other. This is the idea of human violence, conflict. That's why I sometimes refer to the second seal that way. Now I'm going to say something, and I want you just to consider what I'm saying. How many of you are familiar with, in our country today and over the past decade, we've had a lot of riots, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Not fun to talk about, right? You've got bloodshed, people going up against each other one-on-one. One thing I'll remind you of, look at this on here. It says that this is not local, but it's worldwide. Notice, from the earth. What I want you to see here is by no means am I minimizing the riots and the death that happens today, but those would be more local, aren't they? Imagine, and I really can't, I have no way to describe this in my own mind, I try to think of it. Imagine riots like we've seen before, but on a worldwide scale. Again, there's a difference in foreshadows. The Bible gives us the earth today gives us foreshadows of things. We see riots, we see war. But these judgments are worldwide. And so you see these types of things. But I want to draw you back to the same principle as last time. A crown was given, and the ability for the first horse, the rider, to do what he does was given. Notice when Dave was reading, it was granted to him. A sword was given to him. It's the same general idea. The Lord does allow, he permits things, yet he's still under control. Do you understand? This isn't as though evil is run afoul and there's no chains on it. In other words, there's no breaking, there's no limits to it. Charles Ryrie has this commentary on Revelation, and he says, notice what he puts it this way, the giving of the sword to the rider is an indication that the event is under God's control. What an encouraging reminder. Remember, I think sometimes as Christians we have this idea where I don't want to talk about the tribulation because it's so bad, which I understand that. But one of the things that the book of Revelation teaches is that God is still sovereign even when there's evil and wicked in this world. In other words, is God, we like to say, good all the time? All the time means even when there's evil in this world. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want a God who could only control things when good is taking place. God is in total control. He's allowing, he's permitting these things to happen. I don't particularly want to use this as an example, but in the book of Job, God allows, or does he bring forth the evil on Job? He allows Satan, doesn't he? But what is Satan? Satan is in a box, isn't he? You can take everything up to what? Job's life. So there's that permitting of allowing. Of course, it's a different context there. Psalm 46:10, I thought with this, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in all the earth. One day, amen. Let's read someone, verses, actually Connie was going to read. Connie, would you read verses 5 and 6? So we've seen the first, which is the white, second, which is red. This is going to be the black horse, verses 5 and 6.
When he broke the third seal, I had a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine.
All right, thank you. So we see here, so we've got the first one. So we're looking at the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the first one being white, representative of, as I showed you, I believe, Antichrist. Second is, of course, one we just looked at, which is red, warfare, physical conflict, human violence, all of those sort of synonyms and so forth. But here you see as well this one, the third one, which is the black horse, and this one is traditionally just simply called famine. It's representative of, personified, whatever word you want to use there. But as you notice here, they all follow the same flow as when Connie was reading. When Jesus breaks the third seal, come, and then John looks, and what does he see? Of course, the black horse. The black horse is representative of famine. Now, it is curious here, a scale, because we don't really use this today, I don't think really too much, do we? I mean, you might in some grocery stores, but now they're digital, so I think it kind of ruins the analogy a little bit. But back then, what you would have is a scale, and the scale would determine the cost of something. And so you see this black rider on this black horse, and he comes, and he's got this pair of scales. This is what I like to say, and I'm not really trying to be funny. It's probably going to come across that or slash sarcastic. This is what we call true inflation here. You know, we complain about inflation. Actually, in a weird way, it's easier to teach inflation now than when I actually taught this last. When I was at my previous church, I went through Revelation verse by verse, and it was kind of like I had to go back to a period in the United States where we have inflation. Now, today, do we have inflation? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost like, what, $20 for a gallon of milk? Isn't it something like that? If you get the unfiltered or unfiltered kind, but in all seriousness, but notice what the equivalent is. So it says the four living creatures, verse 6. But notice what the math is on it. It says a quart of wheat for a denarius. The idea here is that a denarii. Was what someone would be given in that day in terms of a whole day's wage. So think of a job that you had, if any of you worked. I hope you did. Everybody's worked, haven't they? Somewhere along the way. So imagine working, and it doesn't matter because you can illustrate this pretty easy. Whether you are in healthcare, whether you are a bus driver, whether you are an accountant, anyone can conceptualize this. Can you imagine working one day to pay for just your food? If you notice, that's what it says. It's a quart of wheat, and it's individual. In other words, it would be just one day's wage to eat. Imagine how much that is. Isn't that amazing that it would be like that? And then you begin to think of the ramifications for that. So I go to work and I make enough money one day to eat for myself for one day. And then begin to think of the implications of that. Well, how do you pay for the internet? How do you pay for, I'm being a little funny, but how do you understand the cataclysmic events of this? And then, of course, how do I pay for my wife? How do I pay for the kids? You see where this goes? This is on a different scale. I will use this as an example. Sometimes people get a little confused because we begin to see these things today, don't we? But we don't see them in their full. I'm going to read something to you. I hesitated to do this because I don't want to confuse you, but you'll get my point here. The Bible tells us that there are things that are going to come, but we get foreshadows. We get glimpses of them along the way. I actually think this is a helpful one. Just listen to this. It's unrelated, but it gives the same idea. It's 1 John 2:18. Children, it is the last hour, and just as you have heard Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrist, plural, have come. You understand? What John is saying is one day there's going to be a final Antichrist. God is going to show you along the way that there's many that are similar types of that. We've seen that in history, haven't we? I mean, you can just name them left and right all the way. And that's sort of the idea I want you to see. We can see where these things happen. Can we see in the second seal what would be happening in the future? Violence and riots worldwide? We get glimpses of it today, don't we? Pockets in different places of the world. With this famine, you see this. Again, I'm going to quote here from David Levy here. If you're interested, we do have on the cart for the library his Revelation commentary. If you're interested, this is where I'm quoting this from. And the other one, this famine, in other words, the famine will affect the lower and middle classes, but the rich will continue to enjoy their luxurious lifestyle. Now, how does he get that? Look back at what Connie was reading. A quart of wheat for denarius and so forth. So we got that part, but notice the rest. But don't harm or damage the oil or the wine. Those are the more luxurious, expensive items. So in other words, the idea there is that the rich will be able to afford those types of luxurious items, but your sort of common foods, the common food that we would eat, would be extremely, extremely expensive. Class warfare, almost in a sense there. I don't think that's exactly what that is, but that's the idea there that Levy's referring to. So the first seal, we think of Antichrist. Second seal is warfare, bloodshed. I prefer calling it human violence because it's a little bit more close to that. But either way, but then the third seal is famine. And this famine, again, is worldwide and so forth. Now, we've covered the three horsemen. Someone read verses 7 through 8, or else I will, and we'll look at the fourth one. This is the last of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and you'll really see here where this is future. It's not present, and it has never happened before. But would someone want to read verses 7 through 8? Yeah, go ahead, Don.
When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living beast of the earth.
All right. Thank you, Don. So let's look at this one. So we've seen, of course, white, red, black, and then the fourth one, obviously representative of death, massive death. You could qualify it by that. But pay attention to it's interesting, verse 8, when Don was reading. You see where it says, I looked and behold an ashen. This is the Greek word we get our word from chlorine. It's called chloros And if that's actually where we get our English word for chlorine, if you can kind of almost hear it in there. But chloros is ashen, but it's actually not pale. Sometimes people will say pale, splitting hairs
pale,
a little
bit. NKGV, it's pale.
Yeah, it's actually sickly pale. That would be the way to understand it. And there's nothing wrong with pale. That's what ashen and pale is. But the Greek text comes from this word. It's called chloros. But here I'm going to read you. This actually comes from a Greek dictionary here. It says, a yellowish like color, like when grass is dried up. It's trying to describe it. So you've got an ashen, you've got a pale. It's really a sickly pale. Do you understand? How many of you have ever seen someone who is sick and they have that sickly pale to them? That's just drawing it out there. It's a italicized. It's obviously an added word, but it helps there. But it's yellowish, almost like grass when it's dried up.
It's liver failure.
What's that again?
Someone with liver failure.
No, yeah, actually, yeah, you wonder if...
We were in a hospital and we did liver transplants where I worked all the time.
Would that be similar to that?
A lot of liver patients and they've just got that yellow tint.
So that is correct, like that's the way, yeah, that is the way you'd kind of think of it. So it is, if you read the Greek, it's chloros, where we get chlorine from. And of course, you see that there is death in Hades. Now, death, of course, that's obvious what that is here. Hades, does anyone know what the difference of the two is or what Hades refers to? It's the abode of the dead, which naturally follows death. I don't need to elaborate on that. When you have death, of course, after that you would have naturally that flows from it. But you'll notice when Don was reading it, this one in particular shows the same thing I'm showing you. Notice that it says that authority was given over a fourth of the earth to do these things. So this is clearly still future. Again, I don't want to minimize things because that's by no means my intent. But if you think of what Don just said, we've seen sickness. We've seen death that has come in big types of things. I hate to use this COVID example, but think of all the death that came from COVID, from all the other plagues that we've seen throughout the history of the world. But again, those are typically local versus worldwide, although we're starting to see things more worldwide today, aren't we? They're less local. And so when you look at these, remember, you've got local today that foreshadows worldwide. John Walvoord has this illustration. It's not pleasant reading, but I want you to think about this because there are some people who will say, oh, this is just representative of the course of time, and they try to minimize it. This is something that is still future. Listen to this. If such a judgment would come upon a world population of 6 million people, it would mean 1.5 billion die. So if it was 6 billion, you've got about 1.5. I mean, he's approximating, of course. We've never seen anything like that, have we? So again, you've got local today that shows us. But I'll tell you the thing that's really curious to me is we seem to be getting plagues that are more worldwide. And they seem to be more spread here. But I want to mention one more thing again. Notice, is this without God's control? In other words, is God just going to allow this famine to run afoul, or does God have this in check? If you read through Revelation, God always has these things in check. In other words, there is restraints on them. Notice, authority was given. Again, it's this idea of the Lord allowing judgment to occur, and it occurs within a restraint. Remember, does God want people to be destroyed? Which is typically what people will say, why read this? I mean, why would God do this? God is allowing this to happen because for so long man has rejected God's appeals. I actually thought of this again this morning, 2 Peter 3:9. God doesn't desire for any to perish, but to all come to, of course, repentance, the knowledge of the truth. God does not desire that. God offers salvation to us. The problem is, one of the things you'll see if you do read through Revelation is even when man knows that it is not only God, it is not only cataclysmic judgment coming on the earth, when they know that it's from God, they still reject it. And in fact, as Revelation judgments get more steeped, they actually get harder and rebel more against God. Man's problem is his hard heart. It only gets harder.
I think it's more and more evil.
God. God causes his good to come on the evil and the good. So what we'll do next time, and I'm going to end us with something that'll be on a positive note, because this isn't, I realize, isn't something we find too comforting. But next week what we'll do is look at the fifth and the sixth seal, obviously the seventh one briefly, because that one isn't anything in terms of judgment. It just unleashes the seventh one. But then I'll show you the comparison of the Olivet Discourse, the early part in Matthew, to these seals, and you'll have a head start on when we get back to Mark at the first of the year, because that's where we'll end up being in Mark's abridged Olivet Discourse. But I do want to end on something, because prophetic teaching, usually if it ends there, sometimes people are discouraged from reading it. But I want you to think about something here. Now just listen to me, nothing profound here. I know you know this. But in the second seal, what was removed from earth? Peace. I thought that it's interesting, you know, what do we sing sometimes this time of the year? Peace on earth and goodwill towards men. Peace on earth comes when Jesus returns at his second coming and he is reigning on the earth in the millennial kingdom. However, do you know that we have peace today even while there's conflict and turmoil? And Jesus even tells his disciples that very thing. In the upper room, we are told that only Christ can give us what the world can't. Jesus told his remaining disciples, John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled or be afraid." We don't need to be troubled or afraid. God's given us these things ahead of time. He's told us the world's going to spin this way. But we have peace today, don't we? We have that inner peace. But one day, of course, Jesus will reign on the earth, and I think we'll then have goodwill towards men. But we're not going to have it until then. I wanted to leave some time for questions, comments. Need me to clarify anything?